John Philip Sousa's march, The Liberty Bell. It was the introductory music for Monty Python's Flying Circus, of course. And at the beginning of 2016, John Cleese and Eric Idle visited Australia with their show Together Again at Last for the first time. We took the opportunity to sit down with them for the first time and talk about music and comedy in music. When Monty Python came up with the Lumberjack song, it was their very first song. But over the years, the role of music on Monty Python increased, and there were whole albums of songs by the end. And of course, musicals like Spamalot that came after the television programme had ended. We talked about music and about songs and about getting the rhythm right and about the joys of Roger's Thesaurus. Eric Idle, John Cleese, welcome to the music show. Maybe we could start by talking about the musical numbers in Monty Python, because they're obviously some of the most famous moments. And I was wondering about common threads, and the only common thread that I could come up with was the patent unsuitability of most of the subjects for turning into songs, you know, whether it's lumberjacking or the sanctity of sperm.
I think that's true. It's a good observation. I think it slipped into... I think Lumberjack was one of the first things we did musically, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and
it
was very unexpected into a... It was a whole barber shop, you know, and he sort of suddenly becomes... I want to be a lumberjack. And he went straight off and the camera moved with him into... And that was rather brilliant. And we had these singers called...
Fred Tomlinson.
The Fred Tomlinson singers. And so I think there were very little music at the beginning.
There was very little music. That was the surprising thing when we did the show at the O2 18 months ago, was how much music there was in it when you compared it with the early shows where there was almost no music at all.
But then it got more musical in some of the movies. For example, The Meaning of Life is a musical. It's got 8 numbers in it. It's a musical.
It's a really good piece, isn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And we did, I remember once we had a contractual obligation to Clive Davis. We didn't know. They'd slipped in an extra album. We owed them an album. So I said, well, we'll call it the Contractual Obligation album. And we did. And I encouraged everybody to write songs, just to give them the real finger. And they wrote very good songs. I mean, John, for example, does Whole of Chopin, about Oliver Cromwell and that Polonaise.
I've written that years before.
But it's still beautifully done.
I'm terribly unmusical. I'm so hopeless at singing that when I was playing a small part in a Broadway musical in 1965, Half a Sixpence of Tommy Steele, I was forbidden to sing. I was only in the chorus numbers, and I had so. Or I was hopeless at the music, and he's really good at the music.
No, but you did some songs on I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again. I've Got a Ferret Sticking Up My Nose.
Oh, that's because I just thought Rose of England. Yes,
and Jonesy has a great baritone voice.
Yes.
It's all over the place, but it's very good. Michael wrote a wonderful song about Finland, the country where I quite like to be, which is such a great line. and then Jonesy had a lovely one about I'm so worried about the baggage retrieval system. So we got all these songs, and then we made almost the entire album was all these weird, wonderful songs.
You're dealing in templates, aren't you? Not to say cliches when it comes to the music, because as you said, you know, the barbershop quartet and the Madrigal group singing about Proust, the Bond song in Brian, which is one of my favourites.
But it had to be that in a sort of nice way, you know. It's the opening of this, the opening of a Jesus film with a Bond theme. It's really great. Because Brian is sort of Jesus with a Bond theme, really, isn't it? And I think that's right. I think it's parody music. Mm. And then I found John DePrey actually writes better than parody music.
Yes.
And he writes really great tunes. For example, I wrote the Galaxy song, and I had a little tune, and, you know, I sang the Galaxy all, and he said, That's not how that song goes. This is how that song goes. And it putting a real melody into it really helped and lifted the song.
But you see, he'd been working with John Debray for years, but I asked John to do the music for Fish Called Wanda. He needed all the music for that too. And then he obviously did the music for Spamalot, and you're still writing shows together, the one you're doing for the BBC as well, right. John, right?
Yeah, no, he's written some lovely, beautiful music. It's very nice.
But the music is actually serious, isn't it? I mean, I suppose the most striking example of that would be Jeffrey Bergen's score for The Life of Brian, which could be in a real biblical movie, and that's why it's so funny, it's so serious.
When we first did Holy Grail, Neil Innes did a completely new soundtrack with sackbuts and ancient music, and the comedy died. So we got rid of all of the music, and we went to Graham's, and we got all the swashbuckling ding da 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 da, and now the comedy works, because it's a parody of those sort of movies, and you needed that sort of music to make it work.
You're listening to The Music Show, and I'm talking to Eric Idle and John Cleese about music. The string quartet in Fawlty Towers. Why a string quartet? Why is it funny?
I don't know, but the moment I heard it, I knew it was exactly right. I think John Howard Davies, who produced the first six shows, and incidentally the first four Python shows, just had a very, very good comedic sense, and he talked to one of the guys resident to musicians at the BBC. And when they came up with that, I thought that's absolutely perfect, the attempt to be a little bit cultivated.
I think the other great thing about the music is that the choosing of Liberty Bell as the theme music was just absolutely spot on.
I was very keen on Susie, you know.
You were?
Yeah, I was, because I remember going to the World's Fair in New York in 1964 or 5, and suddenly I heard this wonderful Susie, and I thought, what the hell is this? And a little wooden train came around the corner with these tiny little carriages about 6 foot long, with people in them, with tubas playing, and I thought, this is wonderfully funny music. And I think I suggested it probably
to
Gilliam.
I think so. I didn't know that.
Well, I'm not sure. You know,
this is like nice going on the road. You'll learn so much because you think one thing. I said, no, that's not how it happened at all.
Yeah, it's the great thing about reading Michael Payne's.
Really?
Oh, sorry. Diaries is that you suddenly discover the things that you had no idea that he thought that was the case, or that somebody had done that. And you told me on the stage that if Python had come out 3 months earlier, it would have been in black and white. I had no idea.
Why?
Astonishing thought, because we would not be a world name if we were black and white. You see what I mean?
Of course.
So how lucky can you get?
I've read, John. An interview, or I heard an interview with you talking about writing, I think, Fawlty Towers, it might have been Wanda, but you were talking about the musical component of the writing, the fact that you have to work at getting the rhythm of lines right, the cadences, in order for them to work, in order for them to be funny. Can you say something about that?
Well, I think it's just to do with the sense of timing, and just as that's vital in music, it's also vital in sport. And since I knew nothing about music, I always saw that trying to hit a forehand drive or an off drive or a tennis backhand, it was so much to do with timing, and so much of not straining to do it, not trying to hit it too hard. And it's exactly the same in humour. If you try too hard, it isn't funny.
But also there's something about rhythm too. Especially that wonderful thing, it has ceased to be, it is no more, it has rung down the curtain and joined the choir invisible.
It
is, you know, that's entirely poetry, really. So, and it comes from Roget, the thesaurus, and you've taken out all the bits that don't hit that rhythm.
As you're writing, I mean, I was fascinated by people writing for the printed page, because until I did the autobiography, I'd never had. But to me, when I write dialogue, I'm always saying it out loud.
Right.
And if it doesn't sound quite right, then you adjust it. And then what Eric's saying is exactly right. You adjust it so the rhythms are right.
But the best prose, the best printed writing is the same, isn't it?
Yes, I think so.
It is, because you hear it in, and when you read, that's why you like a writer, you can feel the rhythm of their prose, and that's what you like. It doesn't matter what they're writing about, it's how they're writing in the sentences and how they flow. And that's why there's a lot of really bad writers.
But when you're reading, you see, I was a lawyer and a scientist, And therefore, my reading was very limited to a very small number of pages with a lot of complex information in them. If I could read 10 pages in a morning about the law of contract and understand them, I'd had a good morning. Whereas somebody doing history or English would read 100 pages in the morning. You see what I mean? So I was always a very slow, painstaking, painful reader. But you were always studying English and reading novels and reading a lot of stuff. Do you hear the words as you read them?
Yes, and I talk them. I talk them too. I talk to myself a lot. Nowadays I do much more, yes. Absolutely.
So you're hearing them being spoken.
But you're also a very slow writer. You're painstaking. I remember writing with you, and I like to throw out all the ideas and get where I'm going to. It's going to be about this and this and this, and what we'll get to hear about there. And then I'll go back and try and structure it. Mm. But you say, he comes through the door and he says, good morning. Yeah, he comes in. Or maybe he says, hello. Or hang on, how about he says, hi. Yeah. Anyway, he comes in. No, oh, I know, I got it. He says, good afternoon. And he's like this detailed, and it's terribly important, actually.
And so until you get the first line right, you can't get the second one.
Well, you see, I think now I work differently, but I think you're absolutely right.
In those days,
I was exactly how I wrote. And what I do now is it's all about getting the overall shape right.
Well, that's then how you I go, used to,
yeah.
Coming back to Roger, I mean, a lot of the most memorable Python sketches are, in a sense, lists, aren't they?
You know,
the parrot and the cheese shop and so
forth. Yes.
Is that why they're memorable?
Oh, no, I think they're just memorable because they're funny, I think. But, I mean, there are some wonderful words out there, and you can very seldom can you remember them all. And if you do get thesaurus out and you start writing, it gives you ideas because you suddenly come across a word, oh, and that has a connotation. So, I don't know. I think lists are funny. I think it's one of the basic principles of comedy is that lists can be funny.
But the whole thing about the cheese shop is it is the repetition.
Yes.
And only about halfway through do you realise this is never going to go beyond the list of cheeses. And it becomes more and more absurd and funny. And when he first read it out, it was silence around the table. People, what the fuck are they going out of their minds? They've been drinking too much. Until suddenly, Michael Palin fell off his seat. He just fell off his seat and was rolling around on the floor. Then we all went, and then we all got into it. But it is like that, because you realize it's never going to go beyond this list. And the answer is always going to be no, or some excuse.
Yes.
So in itself, that's the situation of it, makes you laugh.
Yes. When I was talking about memorability, though, I meant that literally, because, of course, for almost since the beginning of Python, there has been this strange phenomenon, which you must have thought about and probably have a theory about. You know, you go to a party, and in the kitchen there's usually an engineer who's had far too much to drink, who is doing a solo performance of the cheese shop sketch or whatever it is, for nobody in particular, and it's not funny anymore. But except for him, but there is some great achievement, I think, that he feels in getting through it. Now,
yes,
what is that about? Because I can't think of any other comedy.
I can give you an answer. I think it's about a badge, about wearing a badge, which says I like this kind of thing. I am a member of the club that forms an audience for this kind of humour. And I think it's true of radio shows, which is why catchphrases get these disproportional laughs. It's a tribal thing.
But I do remember when I first went to see Beyond the Fringe, I bought the album and I learned every single monologue. And I loved doing it in my little bedroom. Higher and higher, I went, and in all of their voices and everything. And if you do that, you learn, you absorb the writing. And so then you can get your own voice eventually out of it.
But that's a different thing, because on the one hand, I used to do something similar. I used to listen to Peter Cook records.
Yeah.
And I would listen to it, and then I'd literally try and write the thing out. And I'd spend a lot of time trying to recall it, and then I would listen to the record again. And I'd suddenly think, oh, why did I miss that? That's got to go before that, because if it can't go after it. And by doing that quite deliberately, I was teaching myself. So that's a side product. But I think the people, and you're a writer, so you were learning in a way when you did it, right?
Well, it made me want to do comedy.
It yes,
made me
it's want right, to but there was funny. Something there. Yeah, it was more no than question. Just learning it and doing it. And I think it was, comedy, when you laugh together, it's a lovely feeling of reassurance because people are with you emotionally. And I suspect that when people do these, our sketches, it's they're saying, I'm a member of this club. And there was a sense of belonging.
Yes.
Which we all want.
Yes. You've taken Holy Grail and turned it into a musical. I just wonder how hard that was to take something which, you know, was working perfectly well and give it a completely new life to make certain scenes, certain jokes into music.
Well, we'd been looking for subjects, and it suddenly one day I went, duh, the Holy Grail is a perfect subject for a musical because comedy is about the low and the high. So this could be Wagner. You know, it's the quest for the Holy Grail.
Wagner did it, didn't he?
Wagner did it, not so funnily, because he's German.
No.
But that shape in itself is a very good subject, but also, because we had no money, it's all written in tiny little scenes. So you say things like, I'm not dead yet. Well, that's immediately a song. It wasn't easy, but it had a lot of room, and it had three songs in it already, so it had a lot of room to become songs where they could be. And the hardest thing of all was actually to reduce the characters, 98 characters in the entire film, down to a group we could understand and make a play of. That was the hardest, not the songs. Although we did write way too many. We had about 34 cut out in that process.
Do you think there's such a thing as funny music? I mean, do you get Mozart's musical joke? I don't.
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's certain music makes me smile. It's very interesting. You know, for example, when I'm writing, I very seldom play music, but if I do, it's always the same thing.
What?
High Society.
Oh, I love that. I just watched it again.
It's wonderful.
Fabulous.
And I know it so well that it doesn't distract me. If I listen to music that I don't know, then I can't write because I'm listening to the music. But that can just sort of go through you without you really having to respond to it at all, and yet it creates a nice mood.
But presumably you write slightly differently according to whether you're listening to True Love or What a Swell Party This Is.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that you can spur creativity with music just as you can by changing the circumstances in which you're working, you know, by going out and sitting in the park or something like that.
So it helps you get in the right mood.
Yes, and I think you can use it for that. But there's certain humour. I think brass band music, you see, I'm John Philip Sousa, we were talking earlier, but also German brass band music is just hilarious.
Yes, but I meant intentionally funny.
Oh, intentionally funny. No, I think it has to have a what's the adjective from parody?
Parodic.
It has to have a parodic quality to be funny, I think.
Haydn was funny. Is it the Surprise Symphony where they all get up and go?
Yeah,
that's pretty funny. It's a visual gag.
Yes.
Because you always nodded off and, you know, they're all getting up and leaving. Right? So there are moments of humour. And the only other thing that I could say was that I love working on a show where once you have the musician in, now you've got these songs, now you can make the show happen. And it's much easier to write once you have structure of the songs and the music.
Oh, really?
Yes, I play them all the time. It's inspiring. It helps the writing and cutting, and you make it tighter and everything. Because, you know, like in any good show, the song has to continue the plot, not be just stand there and be a song. It must go on.
Yeah, I've never understood that, although I'm hoping one day to turn Fish Called Wanda into a musical, but it takes so long, a musical. You know, it's like the gestation period of an elephant. And you can't really go into it until you are very financially secure, because otherwise there's no money coming in for several months. I want to do it one day.
Yes.
But I've always wondered about songs, and people say that the song has to advance the plot.
It has to do that. Yeah. That's the Russian form of the musical. That's why Casey Nicola was so great and helpful on how to deal with Broadway songs. The thing must go on. You don't stop and just do a song. Many people just think they stop and then they sing. Well, no, that's not true. You should be learning something new about the characters or about what's happening in the plot and the play. Otherwise, it's not a musical.
But if you say something like that I'm not dead yet.
Yes.
How does that advance?
Well, he...
I'm not saying it doesn't. I'm really curious to know.
Because they all sing I'm Not Dead Yet, and they all get together and they go off to war.
Oh,
they said, we're going off to war, we'll have girlfriends, but they're going off to enlist. The whole song is about them not being dead yet, and they're going off to a war to get killed, and sort of the levels of irony, and then off they go and lead off to war.
So it's carrying the story forward.
Exactly.
But also it can be development of character?
It can be development of character. For example, I'm All Alone.
Yeah.
King Arthur sings I'm All Alone. And there's a real genuine movement, the feeling of that, except he's ignored the fact that Patsy's standing next to him. So it becomes hilarious again, and then it becomes moving. I mean, Diane Sawyer would cry. She said it's the most moving thing she ever saw, because he sings, we're all of us alone. We're all by ourselves, we're all alone. So there's a philosophical thing about that, too. And it's kind of moving as well, because you can have it both ways, but both be funny and then be moving.
You see, with Wanda, I thought that what I dislike most about most musicals, and certainly not Spamalot, is that the songs slow it down and hold it up too much.
Then they must go.
Or could they not be very, very short? Could they not just be two or three verses?
They can
you see what
be.
I mean? Because the problem with musicals, I think, it's like sending someone in to mend your computer. Is that they start saying, oh, you have to do this, to do that. Musician, you know, the musical people come in, the choreographers say, and then they take the musical over. And sometimes the musical is more about more than just the music. Do you see what I mean? Do you think there's a danger?
Yes, but Mike Nichols taught us various things, that we would write very simple songs of a verse, chorus, and verse, chorus. He said, no, you need a B section and you need a C section. Because he was great friends with Sondheim. And it was Mike was very good at music. I mean, he put in Simon and Garfunkel into The Graduate. He found that music. He inspired musically, and so you do learn that actually that's what we need, and it is a musical. So there's going to be bits of dance, and there's going to be a different theme coming in, and you know, so that was very instructive to me.
But what did you say about B and C?
Well, like an A, we would write an A part. We'd write a thing and a chorus. That's very simple. But he said, no, now you've got to do a B part.
What
and then
a C part.
Well, it means a whole different thing. A theme comes in, a whole different tempo or a whole different tune or a whole different kind of chorus. And then a C part also. So it isn't just one thing. And so, in other words, musically it evolves.
It
escapes the repetition that you don't like.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting.
When Fish Called Wanda the musical is up and running, we should talk again, John Cleese. But thank you very much, John Cleese and Eric Idle. I know, we're being wound up.
I know.
We're being wound up. Thank you for talking to me on the music.
My pleasure. Very interesting. I enjoyed that.
Are you trying to wind us up?
No. You are wound up.
I get that. That's a play on words, wasn't it?
Yeah, right.
Oh, he's
doing
that.
He's
kind of
pissed.
He's a pest.
We were happy
to
just
that was very interesting.
Thank you very much.
That was very interesting. Nicely done.
Thanks.
Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour.
That's the Galaxy song from Monty Python, The Meaning of Life. There's a video of a small part of that conversation on our website, and you can also find a link to Eric Idle's blog that he wrote while he was in Australia. He even mentions his interview on The Music Show. Tomorrow on the show, one of the greats, Wayne Shorter, the whole hour dedicated to Wayne Shorter and his jazz. It's Christmas Eve. I hope you've been good. I hope Santa comes. We'll be back tomorrow.